and was basically a company town, run for the benefit of the Dutch West India stockholders. After a while, this began to chafe on the settlers. So in 1664, when English ships and troops showed up to attack the settlement, it surrendered without firing a shot. New Amsterdam became New York, named after its new owner, James, the Duke of York. The Duke gave some of his new colony to a couple of friends, who thus began the colony of New Jersey. Despite its new English ownership, New York kept much of its Dutch flavor for decades. Fair trade? The chief purpose of the New Amsterdam colony was trade, and in one of the first such transactions, Dutch leader Peter Minuit gave the local Indians a couple of boxes containing stuff like hatchets and cooking pots, and in return took title to the island of Manhattan, which the Indians didn't claim to own in the first place. The goods have since been estimated to have been worth 60 Dutch guilders, the equivalent of 2,400 English pennies. Hence, the idea that Manhattan was sold for $24. Coping with Native American Troubles. When it came to the Native Americans, English colonists had varying opinions. Some thought they should be treated as pets, others as pests. Some thought the Native Americans should be treated with respect. Others thought they should be exterminated, and still others thought they should be tricked out of their lands and then exterminated. In the southern colonies, trouble between the two groups started almost as soon as the English got off the ships. In 1642, Native Americans, under Chief Opechancanough, attacked settlers over a large area of the Virginia colony and killed about 350 of them. The settlers counterattacked a few months later and killed hundreds of Native Americans. In New Netherland, the Dutch settlers murdered nearly 100 Native Americans in their sleep, cutting off their heads, and kicked them around the streets of New Amsterdam. That launched a nasty war that ended when 150 Dutch soldiers killed about 700 Native Americans at a battle near present-day Stamford, Connecticut. In New England, thanks in part to the good initial relations between the Pilgrims and local tribes, war was averted until 1634, when a rowdy pirate named John Stone and seven of his crew were murdered by Native Americans the settlers decided were from a tribe called the Pequot. After an uneasy 2-year truce, Puritan soldiers and their Native American allies attacked a Pequot fort near Mystic River, Connecticut. In about an hour, they burned the village and slaughtered 600 men, women, and children. In September 1638, the Pequots surrendered. As many as 2,000 of them were sold as slaves in the West Indies or given to rival tribes. The Pequots were all but exterminated, and the Native American wars in New England were over for nearly 40 years. But in 1675, a Native American named Metacom, called King Philip by the settlers because he liked English customs, decided to push the white invaders out once and for all. The result was King Philip's War. This time, the Native Americans used guns and attacked everywhere. By the time the 2-year war was over, half the settlements in New England had been destroyed, and the English were on the edge of being driven into the sea. Finally, however, the colonies united while the Native Americans did not, and the tide began to turn. King Philip was killed in August 1676, and the war finally ended. It would be 40 years before the area recovered enough to begin expanding its boundaries into the frontier again. Chapter 4. You Say You Want a Revolution, 1700 to 1775. In this chapter, engaging in the First World Wars, relaxing religious views, fighting the French and the Native Americans, again, alienating the colonists with annoying acts, taking on the Redcoats, the battle for independence begins. By the beginning of the 18th century, European powers had been alternately exploring the New World and sparring over what they found. It was time for the main event, a showdown for control of the American continent. Actually, it was a time for a series of main events. As this chapter unfolds, Europe engages in a succession of wars in which America is not only a pawn, but also a battleground. Britain comes out on top, but her relationship with the American colonies is dramatically changed. Britain views the colonies mainly as economic enterprises, whereas the colonists have a growing dislike for being told what to do by a distant government. The differing perspectives clash until, as the chapter ends, Britain gets popped in the snoot. Looking at America in 1700. The English colonies in America had filled in the gaps between the first two settlements in Virginia and Massachusetts by 1700, and, in fact, had gone beyond them. They now stretched from Maine to South Carolina, but they were a pretty skinny bunch as colonies go. Few settlers lived more than 75 miles from the Atlantic coast, and vast stretches of land lay unsettled by any nation, although claimed by more than one. The population had reached 275,000 to 300,000, including 25,000 African slaves. Most people, as many as 90%, lived in small communities or farms. The population of New York City was about 5,000. Charlestown, now Charleston, about 2,000. Many of the newcomers weren't English, but people from other Western European regions, such as Ireland, France, Scotland, and Germany, as well as the Scandinavian countries. The colonies were maturing as they grew. Boston and Philadelphia were major publishing centers. Small manufacturing firms were turning out goods such as furniture and iron products that lessened the colony's dependence on goods from England. And increasing secularism was loosening the hold of religious authority on everyday life. In fact, things were going along okay, except for all that fighting in Europe. Colonizing New France. While New England was filling up with Puritans and the southern colonies with tobacco growers, the area of North America dominated by the French was progressing more slowly. By 1663, when what is present-day Canada officially became a French crown colony, Quebec had only about 550 people, and the entire region had fewer than 80,000 Europeans by 1750. French officials did take steps to increase the population. Bachelors were censured, and fathers of unwed 16-year-old girls were fined. But the population remained low, especially compared to the English colonies. One reason for the lack of settlers was that the colony was strictly Catholic, and Protestants from France were banned. Many French Protestants thus settled in the English colonies. Another reason was a Looney Tunes system carried over from the Middle Ages that awarded vast tracts of the best land to just a few people. A third reason was the emphasis on fur trading, conducted by men called Codes de Bois, runners of the woods, instead of on agriculture, for which people had to settle down. Although few in number, the French were daring explorers, roaming as far south as present-day New Orleans and as far west as the Rocky Mountains. But the lack of permanent settlements by the French in the vast areas they explored, coupled with their small numbers, spelled trouble for their efforts to hold on to what they had when the wars in Europe spilled over to America. Fighting the First True World Wars. 18th-century royalty didn't need much of an excuse to start a war. They fought over everything, from who should be the next king of Spain to the lopping off of a sea captain's ear. Their willingness to fight was based partly on greed for more territory and the wealth it could bring, and partly on their fear that other countries would beat them to it and become more powerful. Remember, what made these wars different from their predecessors was that they were global in scope, fought all over Europe, India, North and South America, and the Caribbean. The main combatants were the French and English, although the Spanish, Dutch, and Austrians did their share of fighting. France and England were pretty even matches. England had a better navy, but France had a better army. In North America, England's colonies had a much larger population, 1.5 million compared to the French colonies' 80,000 in 1750. England's colonies had a much more varied economy, the protection of the English navy, and the support of the Iroquois Confederacy, a six-tribe alliance of Native Americans who hated the French. The French colonists, on the other hand, had better military leaders, did less quarreling among themselves than the English colonists, and had Native American allies of their own. So here's what happened in the first three true world wars. King William's War. King William's War was the warm-up bout. After a revolution by Protestants in England, James II, a Catholic, was tossed out. Protestant William III and his wife, Mary, were brought in from the Netherlands and put on the throne in 1689. This didn't sit well with the French king, Louis XIV, a Catholic. After William III sided with other countries against France in a territorial dispute, a war was on in Europe that lasted until 1697. In America, the war went back and forth. The French led Native American raiding parties into New York and practiced a kind of warfare that was to become known as guerrilla fighting, ambushes and hit-and-run attacks. The English outlasted the attacks, but botched attempts to conquer Quebec and Montreal. The war pretty much ended in a draw. Queen Anne's War. After King William's War ended, Europe took all of 4 years to catch its breath. Then in 1701, Louis XIV of France tried to put his grandson on the throne of Spain. Queen Anne, who had succeeded William in England, objected, and they were back at it again. This time, the English colonists found themselves fighting the Spanish in the south and the French in the north. As with the previous war, there were few big battles and lots of raids and counter-raids, with both sides employing Native American allies. When the war finally ended in 1713, Louis XIV got to put his grandson on the Spanish throne, but England got Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and the Hudson River Valley, which put it in good position to take over even more of Canada in future wars. The right to compare governors to monkeys. John Peter Zenger was a German-born printer who, in 1734, was also the editor of a New York newspaper called the Weekly Journal. After articles appeared attacking the policies of Governor William Cosby and comparing Cosby and his supporters to monkeys and dogs, Zenger was charged with seditious libel and jailed. At his trial, Zenger's attorney, a Philadelphia lawyer named Andrew Hamilton, argued the articles were basically true, and truth was a valid defense against libel. The judge, a friend of Cosby, told the jury to ignore Hamilton's argument. Instead, the jury ignored the judge and set Zenger free. Although the case didn't immediately win the press the freedom it would enjoy later, it did help establish the foundation that prevents U.S. government officials from stifling printed material. It also reaffirmed the old English tradition of juries ignoring judges when impressed by an eloquent lawyer. King George's War. Most wars have more than one cause, but historians with a whimsical side like to start the story of King George's War with an English smuggler named Robert Jenkins. Spanish revenue agents caught Jenkins in 1731, and in the course of being interrogated, he involuntarily had one of his ears removed. "Take this back to the king, your master," a Spanish official was said to have said, "whom, if he were present, I would serve in the same fashion." Jenkins did take his ear back to England, but he took his time about it and didn't actually tell his tale to Parliament until 1738. It didn't matter much, and a new war was on anyway. It eventually merged with a larger war that broke out in Europe. In America, the same kind of fighting that had taken place in the earlier wars was taking place again. The British colonists took a key port called Louisbourg, which commanded the Gulf of St. Lawrence, but they had to give it back as part of the 1748 treaty that settled the war. Awakening to greater religious freedom. Despite the nagging presence of almost continual war, the American colonies were doing pretty well. And as the colonists did better economically, they began to loosen up in terms of their religious beliefs, too. Pennsylvania, said a German observer by way of example, is heaven for farmers, paradise for artisans, and hell for officials and preachers. It wasn't so much that Americans were becoming less devout, but more a function of their becoming less rigid and more likely to question the practice of most clergy to dictate exactly what they were to think and believe. In the 1730s, a reaction to this shifting of religious attitudes resulted in what came to be known as the Great Awakening. Its catalyst was a genius named Jonathan Edwards. Tall and delicately built, Edwards entered Yale at the age of 13. By the time he was 21, he was the school's head tutor. He was a brilliant theologian and wrote papers on insects that are still respected in entomological circles. Edwards was also, excuse the expression, a hell of a public speaker. The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked, he thundered in a sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. But Edwards' message, preached to mass audiences throughout New England in the 1730s and 1740s, was not just fire and brimstone yelling. Edwards believed that God was to be loved and not just feared, and that internal goodness was the best way to be happy on this earth. Edwards was eventually surpassed on the revival circuit by a Georgia-based minister named George Whitefield. Called the Great Itinerant because of his constant traveling, Whitefield drew crowds in the thousands. On one crusade, he traveled 800 miles in 75 days and gave 175 sermons. Equipped with an amazing voice and a flair for the melodramatic, Whitefield quite literally made members of his crowds wild. He made 7 continental tours from 1740 to 1770, and it's safe to say he was America's first superstar. Remember, although the Great Awakening had run its course by the time of the American Revolution, its impact was deep and lasting. It sparked widespread discussions about religion that in turn led to the development of new denominations, which in turn helped lead to more religious tolerance among the colonists. Several of the new or revitalized denominations were encouraged to start colleges, including Brown, Princeton, Dartmouth, and Columbia, to ensure a steady stream of trained ministers. The Great Awakening also helped break down barriers among the colonies and unify them through their common experience with it. And as the first spontaneous mass movement in America, it heightened the individual's sense of power when it was combined with that of others and emboldened them to question the status quo. The French and Indian War. Despite being filled with the divine spirit of the Great Awakening, or maybe because of it, American colonists were ready by 1750 to once more fight the French and Native Americans. The first to do so were led by a tall, 22-year-old Virginia militia captain named George Washington. This time, the World War, called the 7 Years' War in Europe and dubbed the French and Indian War in the New World, started in America. English speculators had secured the rights to 500,000 acres in the Ohio River Valley. At about the same time, the French had built a series of forts in the same area as a way to keep lines of communication and supply open between Canada and Louisiana. In 1754, a year after he had conducted a diplomat spy mission, Washington was sent to the Ohio country with 150 men. They ran into a French detachment, the Virginians fired, and the French fled. "I heard the bullets whistle," Washington wrote later, "and believe me, there is something charming in the sound." The French set out to charm Washington by counterattacking a fort the young Virginian had hastily put up, and aptly named Fort Necessity, and by forcing Washington to surrender on July 4th. Then, in a stroke of luck for a nation yet unborn, the French let Washington lead his men home. Unifying the colonies. While Washington was savoring his first taste of battle, representatives of 8 of the 13 colonies were meeting in Albany, New York, at the request of the British government. The purpose was to see whether the colonies could be unified. The British wanted more unity because they figured it would make it easier to fight the French and also to govern the colonies. But a few far-seeing colonists, most notably a Philadelphia printer, inventor, scientist, and man about town named Benjamin Franklin, saw the meetings as an opportunity to increase the colony's economic and political clout. Franklin engineered a sound plan for a colonial union, and the gathered representatives approved it. But the assemblies in the individual colonies rejected it, mostly because they felt they would give up too much of their independence. Defeating British General Braddock. On the battlefield, meanwhile, the British had sent two of their worst regiments to the colonies and given command to a general named Edward Braddock. Though undeniably brave, he had 5 horses shot from under him in one battle. Braddock was arrogant and a plotting bozo when it came to military strategy. He was also contemptuous of the American militia under his command. In 1755, Braddock and a force of about 1,400 men, including Washington, marched on French forts in the Ohio country. A force of French and Native Americans surprised the British force. Braddock was killed, along with almost 1,000 of his men. Braddock's defeat was just one of a bunch of losses the British suffered over the next 2 years. The war in America merged with a war in Europe that involved all the major European powers. It went badly for the British in both theaters. Outfighting the French. In 1757, however, things began looking up. An able administrator named William Pitt became head of the London government. Pitt skillfully used the superior British Navy and appointed good military leaders. Remember, among them were James Wolfe and Geoffrey Amherst. Wolfe and Amherst led a British force against the French fortress city of Quebec in 1759. In one of the most important battles fought in North America, the British took the city. Montreal fell in the following year, and the French were finished in the New World. The war was formally settled by the Treaty of Paris in 1763. The British got all of Canada, all of America east of the Mississippi, Florida, and some Caribbean islands. The American colonists got rid of the decades-old threat from the French. More than in previous wars, men from different colonies fought alongside one another, lowering barriers among the colonies. Future leaders matured, and the animosity and friction that sprang up between British military leaders and the Americans lingered long after the war was over. Growing like a weed. If there was one inarguable fact about the American colonies in the mid to late 18th century, it was that they were growing like crazy. In 1730, the population of the 13 colonies was about 655,000. Boston was the biggest city, with a population of about 13,000, while New York and Philadelphia were home to about 8,500 people each. By 1760, the population had reached 1.6 million, not including African slaves, and by 1775, the non-slave population stood at 2.5 million. Philadelphia was now the largest city, with a population of about 34,000. Accounting for the population explosion. The population explosion was caused by two things. One was the natural birth rate of the colonists, partly because of the time-honored farm family tradition that large families meant more people to work, and maybe because there wasn't much else to do on those long winter nights in the country. The size of many American families was astounding. Benjamin Franklin wrote of a Philadelphia woman who had 14 children, 82 grandchildren, and 110 great-grandchildren by the time she died at the age of 100. The growth rate was even more astounding when you consider the high infant mortality rate. One woman was reported to have lost 20 children at birth or soon thereafter. But the growth was by no means all from within the colonies. Immigration continued at a brisk pace, not only from England, but also from other Western European countries. A 1909 population study estimated that at the time of the American Revolution, about 82% of the white population was from England and Wales, 5% from Scotland, 6% from the German states, and about 7% from Holland, Ireland, and other countries. Remember, despite a post-war recession after the fighting with the French stopped in 1763, the colonies were on a fairly sound economic foundation. About 90% of the colonists were involved in agriculture, with tobacco, corn, rice, indigo, and wheat being the main crops. Fishing and whaling were big in New England. Timber was the top manufacturing product, and because trees were plentiful and cheap, shipbuilding boomed. By the time of the American Revolution, one-third of the British Navy had been built in America. The involuntary arrivals. One of the fastest-growing segments of the 18th-century American population didn't grow voluntarily. In 1725, an estimated 75,000 African slaves resided in the colonies. By 1790, the number was 700,000. The 1790 census reported that all but three states had slaves: Maine, Massachusetts, and Vermont. 43% of the people living in South Carolina belonged to other people. In Virginia, 39% were slaves. More than a few colonists raised their voices in alarm at the increasing number of slaves. Some protested for humanitarian reasons. Benjamin Franklin argued the slave system didn't make sense from an economic perspective. Even the most ardent pro-slavery apostles had their doubts. Some were afraid of slave uprisings if the numbers continued to grow, while others wanted to stop the importation of slaves so the value of the ones already in America would increase. But the British government refused to allow bans on slave importation by the colonies for fear of damaging the lucrative trade. This refusal became a sore spot between Britain and America. Living the good life. Although the colonists shared problems common to people all over the world in the 18th century, such as nasty epidemics, they generally ate better, lived longer, and were more prosperous than any of their European counterparts. Land was cheap and had to sustain fewer people because the population was smaller. Because labor was often in short supplies, wages were higher, which raised the standard of living. While enjoying the protections of the formidable British Empire's military, the average American colonist, if he paid any taxes at all, paid far less than his British cousin. The argument against British taxes, put forth by the eloquent Boston lawyer James Otis, that taxation without representation is tyranny was a bit hypocritical. After all, more than a few Americans had to pay taxes to American local governments and still couldn't vote or didn't have a representative in the colonial assemblies. Moreover, for the most part, Britain didn't interfere with the colony's internal affairs. Mostly, the mother country concerned itself with defense and trade issues, and many of the trade laws were mutually beneficial to both sides of the water, unless you happen to be a big-time smuggler like John Hancock, who later became the first to sign the Declaration of Independence and was public enemy number one as far as the British were concerned. So, most Americans in the 1760s and early 1770s had no interest in independence from Britain. What they wanted was what they had: protection by the world's mightiest navy, generally cozy trade rules, and freedoms and rights unequaled in the rest of the world. Britain, however, couldn't, or thought it couldn't, afford to maintain the status quo. Heading toward divorce with Britain. After more than 60 years of almost continuous war, the British national debt had soared, because a lot of the debt had come about by defending Americans from the French and Native Americans in America. The British government concluded that it was only fair that the Americans pay for part of it. In addition, the British and the Americans fundamentally disagreed on what role Parliament, the British governing body, should play in the colonists' lives. For Britain, it was simple. Parliament made the rules for Britain and all its colonies. For America, however, the role of Parliament was negligible. The colonists wanted to come up with their own rules in their own many parliaments and deal directly with the king. In the end, it came down to a fight over who should tell whom what to do. Starting in 1763, Britain and her American colonies began to irritate each other almost incessantly. Like an impatient parent with a headstrong child, Britain tried different methods to instill discipline. Only, America wasn't such a kid anymore, or as Ben Franklin put it in verse, "We have an old mother that peevish is grown. She snubs us like children that scarce walk alone. She forgets we're grown up and have a sense of our own." And as happens in family quarrels, incidents and issues that by themselves could be smoothed over began to pile up. In this case, the irritants helped lead to a revolution. The Proclamation of 1763. One of the first things Britain wanted to do after finally whipping the French was to calm down the Native Americans, who were understandably upset by the generally pushy and often genocidal actions of the colonists. So King George III decided that as of October 7, 1763, no colonist could settle beyond the crest of the Appalachian Mountains. That decision meant America would remain basically a collection of coastal colonies. The idea was to give everyone a sort of time out after all the fighting. But even if it was well-intentioned, it was impractical. For one thing, a bunch of colonials were already living west of the dividing line and weren't about to move just because some potentate thousands of miles away said so. Worse, the decree was a slap in the face to those who had fought against the French and Native Americans with the expectation that winning meant they could move west to vast tracts of free land. In the end, it was an unforeseeable law that did nothing but anger the colonists and vex British officials when it wasn't obeyed. The Revenue Acts, 1764. On the other side of the sea, more than a few Brits were peeved that their colonial cousins paid relatively little in taxes, especially because the British were among the highest taxed people in the world. So, British Prime Minister George Grenville pushed a bill through Parliament that was explicitly designed to raise money from the colonists to pay for their defense. The law actually lowered the tax on molasses, but raised or imposed taxes on other things like sugar, wine, linen, and silk. Colonists objected, asserting that Parliament had no right to impose taxes on them without their assent. They also organized boycotts of the taxed goods and increased their already booming smuggling enterprises. Samuel Adams. He was a flop at business and a crummy public speaker, and perhaps America's first truly great politician. More than any of his contemporaries, Samuel Adams kept the colonies on the road to independence. Born to a prosperous family, Adams graduated from Harvard. After failing at a business of his own, he took over a bustling family brewery and managed to run it into the ground. Then he became a tax collector and narrowly avoided jail for mismanaging funds. But Adams was a success at backroom maneuvering. He helped organize the Sons of Liberty, the Boston Tea Party, and the Minutemen. He wrote tirelessly for colonial newspapers on the urge to stand up to Britain, and his letters urging action were circulated throughout America. When the movement seemed to be sputtering, Adams kept it alive almost single-handedly with his writing and organizing. He attended both Continental Congresses as a delegate and was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. But once independence was won, there was no need for a rabble-rouser. Although elected governor of Massachusetts for one four-year term in 1794, Adams had dropped from national prominence by the time of his death in 1803 at the age of 81. The Stamp Act, 1765. Unsatisfied with the revenue from the Revenue Acts, Parliament imposed a new levy on 50 items, including dice, playing cards, newspapers, marriage licenses, college degrees, and just about every other kind of legal document. Some of the taxes doubled the cost of the item. Not only that, the items had to be stamped or have a stamped receipt on them, showing the tax had been paid. British citizens had been paying similar taxes for years, at even higher rates. But American colonists saw the Stamp Act taxes as only the beginning. Paying anything, they argued, was an invitation to be milked dry later. In reaction to the tax, 9 colonies sent 27 delegates to a meeting in New York City. The group drew up a petition and sent it to England, where it was ignored. But the colonies also began a boycott of British goods, which was not ignored. Groups calling themselves the Sons of Liberty encouraged and bullied their fellow colleagues to wear homespun clothing instead of British wool. They also tarred and feathered more than a few would-be tax collectors. The boycott had its desired effect. In 1766, under pressure from British manufacturers, Parliament repealed the taxes. But it also tried to save face by declaring that henceforth it had the right to pass any laws it wanted to govern the colonies. Americans rejoiced at the tax repeal. They praised good King George. In New York, they even erected a statue of him in his honor, and they blithely ignored the warning from Parliament. The Townshend Act, 1767. British Prime Minister William Pitt was a capable leader. But when he had a mental breakdown in 1766, he handed over the government to one of his lieutenants, Charles Townshend, also known as Champagne Charlie, because he was quite eloquent when drunk. A cocky sort, Townshend vowed to squeeze some money out of the obstinate American colonies, and he got Parliament to impose taxes on a number of goods, including glass, paper, paint, and tea. The revenues were to be used to pay the salaries of royal judges and governors in the colonies. To be fair, Townshend also dropped import duties on some American products entering England, thus making their export more profitable for the colonies. It was too small a gesture as far as many colonists were concerned. For one thing, many of them had grown extremely fond of tea and were not keen on paying any tax on it. For another, they didn't like the idea of money going to pay judges and governors. Up until that point, the officials' salaries had been controlled by colonial legislators, which gave them a fair amount of influence over their policies. Eager to show he meant business, Townsend sent two regiments of red-coated British troops, sneeringly dubbed lobsterbacks by the locals, to Boston in 1768. That set up the next confrontation. The Boston Massacre, 1770. Because the soldiers sent to Boston were poorly paid, some of them tried to find part-time work, a practice that didn't sit well with many Bostonians. So it wasn't unusual for fights to break out between soldiers and groups of colonists. On the night of March 5th, a small mob of lowlifes began throwing rocks and snowballs at a British sentry outside the customs house. Another 20 British soldiers appeared with fixed bayonets. The crowd grew to as many as 300 boys and men, and after about 30 minutes of being taunted and pelted with rocks and sticks, one of the soldiers opened fire. A few minutes later, 11 members of the mob were dead or wounded. At a subsequent trial, the soldiers were ably defended by a Boston lawyer named John Adams, and all but two were acquitted. The two soldiers found guilty were branded on the hand and then let go. But the radicals among the colonists milked the incident for all it was worth. A highly exaggerated engraving of the massacre was made by a silversmith named Paul Revere, and copies of it circulated all over the colonies. Ironically, on the day of the incident, the Townsend Acts were repealed by Parliament, except for the tax on tea. The Boston Tea Party, 1773. Despite the widespread publicity surrounding the tragedy in Boston, cooler heads prevailed for the next year or two. Moderates on both sides of the Atlantic argued that compromises could still be reached. Then the powerful but poorly run British East India Company found it had 17 million pounds of surplus tea on its hands. So, the British government gave the company a monopoly on the American tea business. With a monopoly, the company could lower its prices enough to undercut the smuggled tea the colonists drank instead of paying the British tax. But even with lower prices, the colonists still didn't like the arrangement. It was the principle of the tax itself, not the cost of the tea, that bothered them. Shipments of English tea were destroyed or prevented from being unloaded or sold. On December 16, 1773, colonists, poorly disguised as Native Americans, boarded three ships in Boston Harbor, smashed in 342 chests of tea, and dumped the whole mess into the harbor, where, according to one eyewitness, it piled up in the low tide like haystacks. No one was seriously hurt, although one colonist was reportedly roughed up a bit for trying to stuff some of the tea in his coat instead of throwing it overboard. King George III wasn't amused. "The die is now cast," he wrote to his latest prime minister, Lord North, who had succeeded Townsend upon his sudden death. "The colonies must either submit or triumph." The Intolerable Acts, 1774. In response to the Tea Party, Parliament passed a series of laws designed to teach the upstarts a thing or two. They were called the Repressive Acts in England, but to Americans, they were intolerable. The new laws closed Boston Harbor until the colonists paid back the damage they had wrought, thus cutting the city off from sources of food, medical supplies, and other goods. The laws also installed a British general as governor of Massachusetts and repealed such liberties as the right to hold town meetings. At the same time, the Brits passed the Quebec Law, a law that gave more freedom to conquered French subjects in Canada, including the right to continue customs such as non-jury trials in civil cases. Though a sensible thing to do from a British perspective, the Quebec Act incensed Americans, especially at a time when they felt their own freedoms were being messed with. The act also pushed the borders of the Quebec province well into the Ohio River Valley, which infuriated colonials who had fought several wars to keep the French out of that same valley. The acts galvanized the colonies into a show of unity that had only occasionally been shown before. Food and supplies poured in by land to Boston from all over America. And in Virginia, the colonial legislature decided to try to get representatives from all over the colonies together for a meeting. Congressing for the first time. On September 5, 1774, leaders from all the colonies but Georgia gathered in Philadelphia to talk things over. There were 56 delegates, all of them men, and about half of them lawyers. Some, such as New York's John Jay, were politically conservative. Others, such as Virginia's Patrick Henry, were fire-breathing radicals. Despite their differences, the delegates to what is called the First Continental Congress did reach agreement on a number of issues, even though they had no real powers. Several delegates wrote essays that suggested the colony stay under the supervision of the king, but have nothing to do with Parliament. They petitioned Parliament to rescind the offending laws. The group also proclaimed that colonists should have all the rights other British subjects had, such as electing representatives to make the laws they were governed by, and that all trade with Britain should cease until the Intolerable Acts were repealed. The Congress also resolved that if one of the colonies was attacked, all the rest would defend it. And, probably much to the dismay of some members, the Congress resolved to abstain from tea and wine, but not rum, and to swear off recreational pursuits like horse racing and cockfighting until the troubles with England were resolved. The meeting served to draw the colonies closer together than ever before. "The distinctions between New Englanders and Virginians are no more," declared Patrick Henry. "I am not a Virginian, but an American." The Congress adjourned on October 26th, pledging to come back in May if things didn't get better by then. Things didn't. Tough love and fighting words. "I love the Americans because they love liberty, but if they carry their notion of liberty too far, as I fear they do, if they will not be subject to the laws of this country, they have not a more determined opposer than me. This is the mother country. They are the children. They must obey." William Pitt, Member of the House of Lords, 1770. The gentlemen cry, "Peace, peace," but there is no peace. The war has actually begun. Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God! I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death. Patrick Henry, Speech in the Virginia Legislature, March 23, 1775. "Mr. Revere, your horse is ready." The Congress's decision to boycott all trade with Britain was embraced with enthusiasm almost everywhere. Lists of suspected traders who continued to trade were published, and tar and feathers were vigorously applied to those who ignored the boycott. While businessmen in England fretted, the colonists' actions were met with disdain by a majority of the members of Parliament. Lord North, the Prime Minister, resolved to isolate the troublemakers in Massachusetts and thus stifle dissent in other areas. But some British knew better. General Thomas Gage, the British commander-in-chief in America, reported that things were coming to a head. "If you think 10,000 men are enough," he wrote to North, "send 20. If £1,000,000 is thought to be enough, give 2. You will save both blood and treasure in the end." In April 1775, Gage decided to make a surprise march from his headquarters in Boston to nearby Concord, where he hoped to seize a storehouse of rebel guns and ammunition, and maybe arrest some of the rebels' leaders. But the colonists knew he was coming, thanks to a network of spies and militia called the Minutemen, aptly named because they were supposed to be ready to quickly spring into action. One of these were Paul Revere, the son of a French immigrant. In addition to being a master silversmith, Revere made false teeth and surgical tools, and he was pretty good on a horse, too. So, when word came on the night of April 18th that the British were marching on Concord, Revere and two other men, William Dawes and Dr. Samuel Prescott, rode out to warn that the British were coming. After rousing the town of Lexington, Revere and Dawes were captured and briefly detained. But Prescott escaped and made it to Concord. Revere became the most famous of the three, however, because a poet named Henry Wadsworth Longfellow made him the star of a wildly popular poem in 1863. Remember, when the 700 British soldiers marched through Lexington on the morning of April 19th on their way to Concord, they encountered 77 colonials. "Don't fire unless fired upon," said the Minutemen's leader, John Parker. "But if they mean to have a war, let it begin here." Shots were fired, and 8 of the Minutemen were killed. By the time the British reached Concord, however, resistance had been better organized. At a bridge near one of the entrances of the town, British soldiers were attacked, and the fighting began in earnest. Now facing hundreds of colonists who prudently stood behind trees and in houses and fired at the redcoats, the British soldiers beat a disorganized retreat to Boston. More than 250 British were dead, missing, or wounded, compared to about 90 Americans killed or wounded. The war of words was over. The war of blood and death had begun. Chapter 5. Yankee Doodlin', 1775 to 1783. In this chapter, detailing the British and American forces, fueling and formalizing the desire for independence, getting a helping hand from the French, looking at 10 key battles of the war. After blood was spilled at Lexington and Concord, war between Britain and her American colonies was inevitable, even though there were some efforts on both sides to avoid it. British leaders weren't too worried about quelling the disturbance. One British general suggested it wasn't anything that a capable sheepherder couldn't handle. But there's an old saying that it's good to be good, better to be lucky, and best to be both. In this chapter, the American colonists are good when they need to be, and really lucky much of the rest of the time, and win their independence from Britain. They also lay out their reasons for doing so in a remarkable declaration. In this corner, the Brits. The first thing the British had going for them when it came to fighting the Americans was a whole bunch of fighters. The British army consisted of about 50,000 men. They rented another 30,000 mercenary German soldiers. In addition, they had the best navy in the world. And the people the Brits were fighting, the colonists, had no regular army, no navy at all, and few real resources to assemble them. But, as America itself was to find out about 2 centuries later in Vietnam, having the best army and navy doesn't always mean that much. For one thing, the British people were by no means united in a desire to reign in the colonies. When war broke out, several leading British military leaders refused to take part. Some British leaders also recognized the difficulty of winning a war by fighting on the enemy's turf thousands of miles from Britain, especially when the enemy was fighting for a cause. "You may spread fire, sword, and desolation, but that will not be government," warned the Duke of Richmond. "No people can ever be made to submit to a form of government they say they will not receive." 3 factors contributed to Britain's ultimate downfall. The British political leaders who did support the war were generally inept. Lord North, the Prime Minister, was a decent bureaucrat, but no leader, and he basically did what King George III wanted. And some of the British generals were nincompoops. One of them, leaving for duty in early 1777, boastfully bet a fair sum of money that he would be back in England victorious from America by Christmas Day, 1777. By Christmas Day, he had surrendered his entire army. Britain couldn't commit all its military resources to putting down the rebellion. Because of unrest in Ireland and the potential for trouble with the French, who were still smarting from their defeats by the British in the New World, Britain had to keep many of its forces in Europe. Because the Brits didn't take their opponents seriously, they had no real plan for winning the war. That meant they fooled around long enough to give the Americans hope, and that gave the French a reason to believe the colonials just might win, so they provided the Americans with what proved to be indispensable arms, money, ships, and troops. In this corner, the Yanks. When you look at the problems the British had and then look at the dilemmas the Americans faced, it's no wonder the war took 8 years. In the early years, at least, probably as few as a third of Americans supported the Revolution. About 20%, called Loyalists or Tories after the ruling political party in Britain, were loyal to the Crown, and the rest didn't care much one way or another. Because they weren't professional soldiers, many of those who fought in the American army had peculiar notions of soldiering. They often elected their officers, and when the officers gave orders they didn't like, they just elected new ones. The soldiers signed up for a year or two, and when their time was up, they simply went home, no matter how the war or even the battle was going. At one point, the colonial army under George Washington was down to 3,000 soldiers. They also weren't big on sticking around when faced with a British bayonet charge. Many, if not most battles, ended with the Americans running away, so often that Washington once observed in exasperation that they run from their own shadows. Regional jealousy surfaced when soldiers from one colony were given orders by officers from another, and at least one mutiny had to be put down by other American units. The American soldiers were ill-fed, ill-housed, and so poorly clothed that in some battles, colonial soldiers fought nearly naked. About 10,000 soldiers spent a bitter winter in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, literally barefoot in the snow, and about 2,800 of them died. The long and great sufferings of this army are unexampled in history, wrote Washington. They were also paid in currency called continentals, which became so worthless, the phrase "not worth a continental" became a common American saying for decades after the Revolution. Because the money was so worthless, unpatriotic American merchants often sold their goods to the British Army instead, even when American troops wore rags and starved. Others cornered the markets on goods such as food and clothing, stockpiling them until the prices rose higher and higher. As a result, desperate army leaders were forced to confiscate goods from private citizens to survive. About the best thing the Americans had going for them was a cause, because men who are fighting for something often fight better. Indeed, as the war wore on, the American soldier became more competent. By the end of 1777, a British officer wrote home that, though it was once the tone of this British army to treat them in a most contemptible light, they are now become a formidable enemy. The fact that there were 13 colonies was also an advantage, because it meant there was no single nerve center for which the British could aim. They conquered New York, they took Philadelphia, and still the colonies fought on. America also had rapid growth in its favor. Britain, at the expense of £3 million, has killed 150 Yankees in this campaign, which is £20,000 ahead, observed Ben Franklin early during the fight. During the same time, 60,000 children have been born in America. But maybe most important, the Americans were lucky enough to choose an extraordinary leader and smart enough to stick with him. Mr. Washington goes to war. George Washington has become so mythic a figure that some people think his importance has been blown out of proportion. That's too bad, because Washington was truly one of the most remarkable people in American history. At the time of the Revolution, Washington was 43 years old. He was one of the wealthiest men in the colonies, having inherited land and money and married into more. Although he was a soldier in the wars against the French and Native Americans, Washington had never commanded more than 1,200 men at any one time. Other colonials had more military command experience. But the Second Continental Congress, which had convened in May 1775, had taken over the running of the Revolution, even though no one had actually asked it to, decided on Washington as the Continental Army's commander-in-chief.